The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory America, bonjour, hi Canada, you Hewitt, inside the Beltway live on this August the 24th, 2021, another grim day in Kabul. 4,500 people are stranded inside the airport waiting for a plane, thousands more outside of the airport, tens of thousands afraid to come to the airport, and Joe Biden did this yesterday when asked questions about it after his vaccine address, cut number 16.
Dr. Troops, thank you.
He walked away. Now, the headlines are all the same from the Washington Post. Biden faces pressure to extend Afghan evacuation mission as Taliban warns against doing so. New York Times, Taliban reject an extended deadline on the U.S. race to finish evacuations. Back to the Post, Biden to decide on extending deadline evacuation mission as soon as today. From the Wall Street Journal, U.S. struggles to count its citizens in Afghanistan as Biden weighs withdrawal day. Remember, we have no idea how many Americans are there. They won't even give us a minimum number. In the ABC News interview that was not released in its full from ABC, George Stephanopoulos said there were, 10 to 15,000 people there, and you're going to get them all out? He asked a second question, so when the president said yes, he didn't confirm the 10 to 15,000. Nobody will confirm a minimum number. What we need is, what's the minimum number of Americans we know are left in Afghanistan? What's the minimum number of SIV holders? What's the minimum number of priority two people? Those are the three categories. And, of course, allies, but allies can be lumped in with Americans. A Brit and American are going to be the same thing since the UK and the French are manning the airport jointly. Along with the French, I believe. But they don't have a number for us. People get asked over and over again. The British Telegraph reports extension to Afghanistan withdrawal deadline unlikely, warns the defense secretary ahead of a G7 summit on the Kabul catastrophe and the catastrophe in Afghanistan. The Telegraph's leading columnist Dominic Green's headline is, "The Washington elite have turned on Biden. Watch out for the Harris presidency." That's really kind of over the top, but indeed, there isn't a kind word to be said. There's other news, of course. A new governor in New York, as the disgraced Andrew Cuomo has been obliged to resign. Kathy Hochul is sworn in, and the California wildfires have forced the evacuation of more than 40,000 people. California is better at evacuating people than the federal government is from Afghanistan. I also have a story, by the way, 1-800-520-1234. I've got a lot coming up today in terms of guests. So I'd like to hear from you now, 1-800-520-1234, about this exchange. All right, cut number. First of all, this is what our allies think of a Singapore Prime Minister Lee in a joint press conference with Kamala Harris yesterday in Singapore said this, cut 19.
Countries calculations and take positions, and they have to make recalculations and adjust their positions from time to time. Sometimes it can be done smoothly, sometimes there are hiccups, sometimes there's things go awry and take time to put right.
Things go awry? That was a very diplomatic way of saying Kabul is FUBAR, and the Jen Psaki, the pressure is getting to her, questioned by Peter Doocy, a famous clip already, cut number 11.
The president likes to say America is back, but his policies have Americans getting beat up by the Taliban and Afghans handing babies over barbed wire fences. Is that what he meant when he said America is back?
What the president meant is that we are going to continue to lead in the world, including being the leaders in evacuating not just our Afghan partners, not just American citizens, but now also our allies. And we have done that by evacuating approximately 42,000 people over the last month. That is Americans leading. That is our men and women in our military leading on the ground, securing the airport after the Afghans fled and didn't secure the airport, and ensuring that we are taking care of our partners as we promised to.
Notice she's blaming the Afghans for fleeing the airport. The airport was allegedly the place that the United States had decided to secure after abandoning Bagram. Then came the quote that's going to live for a long time, cut number 10.
But does the president have a sense that most of the criticism is not of leaving Afghanistan, it's the way that he has ordered it to happen, by pulling the troops before getting these Americans who are now stranded? Does he have a sense of that?
First of all, I think it's irresponsible to say Americans are stranded. They are not. We are committed to bringing Americans who want to come home, home. We are in touch with them via phone, via text, via email, via any way that we can possibly reach Americans.
All right,
to
so
get
America,
them home if they want to.
Are people stranded? 1-800-520-1234. Jake Tapper thinks they're stranded on CNN, cut number 4.
Look, I understand that people are working long hours in the White House, the National Security Council, State Department, Pentagon, and over in Kabul to get Americans out of that country. And I understand the White House wanting to reassure the nation that all Americans will ultimately be evacuated. But there are no doubt Americans who feel stranded in Afghanistan right now.
Of course there are. It's absurd for the White House, and it tells you something about Joe Biden. This is Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Democrat from Connecticut, a member of the House. Cut number 23.
I think they were turned away potentially by Turkish soldiers who are assisting in guarding the airport. And so there appears to be some communications issues between the State Department and the security who are guarding the airport. But this is incredibly frustrating, as you can imagine, because A, it's impossible, almost impossible to get to the airport right now. And B, doing so involves risk of grave harm because you're exposing yourself not only to the Taliban, but also to others who might pose harm. And so these are the types of logistical issues that we need to work through right away, because, you know, despite our best intentions, if we don't get these people out of harm's way, we won't have accomplished the mission.
They're going to be stranded, in other words. Britt Hume was on with our friend Guy Benson on his radio show yesterday, said this, cut number 1.
But anybody who ever heard him speak for any length of time could tell that this guy, this was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And, he could talk forever and was famous for it. But you never had the sense that he was terribly smart. And on top of that, now he's manifestly senile. And between those two things, this is a man with very, very severe limitations who is well too old, in my opinion, to be the president of the United States.
That's what the British Telegraph means by media elites in Washington, D.C., turning on the president. And by the way, what Britt has the courage and the standing to say on air, many people are saying off air. I just think he's an old guy, limited as old people often are in their capacity to absorb information and change their mind, adapt to facts on the ground. So what do you think? 1-800-520-1234. Are Americans stranded in Afghanistan? 1-800-520-1234. 48,000 allegedly have been brought out. We do not know the denominator. First-time callers only. First-time callers only. I just want to hear from new people. And if there aren't any new people listening, I'd be amazed. But I don't want to hear from the same old, same old. I know what you think. First-time callers only. Are Americans stranded in Afghanistan? Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined now by David Drucker of the Washington Examiner. David, the president is expected to address the August 31st deadline today. Got any reporting on that?
I don't have any reporting on that, but I've seen the president say already more than once, I believe, that we're going to stay until we get every American out. I think the White House, just putting aside the president for a minute, you know, can't seem to get its messaging straight because one minute they're saying one thing, the next minute they're saying another. It's made this thing very hard for the U.S. government to project command and control. And I think that's been Biden's biggest misstep here, aside from the obvious initial policy disaster, is that once this whole thing went south, what you need a president to do is to speak plainly about the problems. You don't even have to admit mistakes. That gets very political. You just have to say, yes, there is a problem, and you need to project command and control, and that has been the biggest deficiency.
We also are unable to obtain a minimum number. I've heard Jake Sullivan, Jen Psaki, John Kirby, Ned Price all explain why we don't know how many Americans are in Afghanistan multiple times. The question, though, is what's the minimum number of people that we know are there? Has anyone offered up any answer on the minimum number, David Drucker?
Not that I've seen. And I think this is a case where, again, it comes back to, and I sound like a broken record here, command and control, understanding the scope of the problem, believing at least that you understand what it takes to solve the problem, and that the president, while he started to speak more often about this and attempt to project some command and control, he still has, you know, people around him that sometimes don't say what he says, that are still appearing if they're trying to sort of smooth this over for him. And I think they've just got to get better at saying, yeah, this is a problem. This is what we know. This is what we don't know, but are trying to find out. And then get to a place where they have command of all the facts and they present a plan that, even if it gets criticized, is at least a plan that people can wrap their arms around for dealing with the problem.
David Drucker, I think he's allowed 10 reporters to ask him questions now in two, quote, press conferences over the course of 10 days of disaster. It's like a question a day. Is the president failing in his job of communicator to the American people?
Well, he's failed at his job to communicate, and I don't, and even as a reporter who wants to be able to ask and have these questions answered, I don't think it's because of a lack of taking questions. I just, you know, it was such a slow ramp up where initially the president just wasn't saying much at all and wasn't very visible. I feel like, you know, as an observer here, they finally started to at least get some of this under control when the president on Friday or whatever day it was decided not to go back to Wilmington and realized he needed to first stay in the White House. Then we heard from him on Sunday again, and we're going to hear from him again. Like it seems to be this sort of slow understanding that we need to be present, we need to communicate more. Would it be helpful if he took questions? Sure. Would it show a little bit more, you know, maybe robust leadership? Sure. But I think the main thing is not the questions. It's just identifying the problem, presenting a plan, presenting confidence, and speaking more plainly to our adversaries that, you know, whatever you think you just saw, and we all know what we just saw, we've still got our eye on the ball when it comes to the things that matter. And that would be very reassuring to our allies as well if we spoke more forcefully about that and just stopped trying to act as though it wasn't problematic.
David, here is Britt Hume, a senior statesman among the media, very responsible fellow, on Guy Benson's radio show last night, cut number one.
But anybody who ever heard him speak for any length of time could tell this was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And, he could talk forever and was famous for it. But you never had the sense that he was terribly smart. And on top of that, now he's manifestly senile. And between those two things, this is a man with very, very severe limitations who is well too old, in my opinion, to be the president of the United States.
David Drucker, that's saying the quiet part out loud. I'm not sure that he's senile at all. I do think he's old and doesn't absorb information or change positions or recognize new facts on the ground. Is Britt Hume the only person you've heard that from?
He's the only person I've heard that from. Look, I have a lot of respect for Britt Hume. He's been a mentor of sorts to me. But I disagree with him, not in a clinical sense. I mean, who the hell knows? But Biden doesn't strike me at all as senile. He strikes me as the Joe Biden on foreign policy I've observed for 40 years. And I would look at it this way, Hugh. I mean, there's another way to look at this. If you look at how the president has handled COVID, you know, he set benchmarks for vaccinations. He set deadlines. They weren't met. We had a resurgence because of the Delta variant. And the president, whether you agree or disagree with his policy, actually made adjustments based on conditions on the ground and spoke very plainly about the problem. It goes against political interest because he was elected to shut down the virus, as he said, and he was still willing to say, look, this problem isn't solved. I don't want to do math. I don't want to do other mandates, but we have to make adjustments. If he had handled Afghanistan that way from the beginning, made adjustments based on conditions on the ground and not stuck stubbornly to a policy that he wanted, he wouldn't be in this mess and the country wouldn't be in this mess.
The difference, David, is that the OODA loop on Afghanistan is much smaller in time and intensity than that on COVID. He is not reacting in real time to a terrible circumstance. Maybe he'll get better. I pray that he does. David M. Drucker on Twitter. Coming back with his colleague from the Washington Examiner, Byron York. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Breaking news from the Washington Post this morning. The CIA's director William Burns, met with the senior leader of the Taliban yesterday in Kabul. William Burns went over there secretly, held the meeting face-to-face with Abdul Ghani Baradar. It's the highest face-to-face encounter between the Taliban and the Biden administration. Baradar is also the man who met with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo last year. I'm joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner. Byron, does that maybe give us a clue as to why the administration is being so secretive as to what is going on and the timeline in Kabul? Hello, Byron. You might be on. Go ahead. You're on now.
Okay. It could, but it underscores the perhaps the ugliest fact of this entire affair, which is that the United States is dependent on the good graces of the Taliban. It sounds insane to say that, but we are dependent on the good graces of the Taliban to get Americans out, American citizens, American military forces, and those Afghans who aided the American military effort. So the fact that, you know, we're having meetings with the Taliban, which in this case I think has to be done, underscores the dependence position that the president has put us in here.
Now, Baradar, of course, does not control al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of the other splinter groups that are there. It is unclear to me whether or not we actually have operational security guarantees from the Taliban. But the thing that I'm certain about is that we don't know how many Americans are there. And I doubt that the United States government does. But do you think they have at least a minimum number they might release to us, Byron?
Well, I was relieved to find out yesterday that they're not stranded. The Americans are not stranded because the White House told me that. But I think it's well, let's say this. If the U.S. government knows how many Americans are there and is not saying, I don't know the explanation for that, but I'm taking them at their word that they literally do not know how many Americans are in Afghanistan. And by the way, how many of those want to leave? I would assume there's some group that does not want to leave, but I would also assume that most of them do. So right now, we appear to have no capability to gather those Americans in groups around Kabul and around the country and then rescue them. We have, because we did this in a backward way, and former President Trump is saying this, and he's right, which is you don't take out the military first and then try to get the civilians. You use the military to get the civilians out, and then the military are the last to leave because they have the capacity to fight. So right now, we're in an incredibly weak situation.
And I do believe they have to know. They have to have a number that is a minimum number. Jen Psaki says we're in touch with them by phone, by email, by fax, by everything. We have to know at least how many people are there, and they won't tell us. Now, let me play for you Britt Hume with Guy Benson last night. Cut number one.
But anybody who ever heard him speak for any length of time could tell this guy, this was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And, he could talk forever and was famous for it, but you never had the sense that he was terribly smart. And on top of that, now he's manifestly senile. And between those two things, this is a man with very, very severe limitations who is well too old, in my opinion, to be the President of the United States.
Byron York, your comment.
Well, I haven't talked to Brit about this. I believe that he's using the word senile carefully, in the sense he's not saying that Biden has dementia or any sort of specific malady. But I'm looking at an article that I wrote in April of 2019 with the headline, Biden and Bernie are too old to be president. And it was clear long before Joe Biden won the Democratic nomination that he was too old to be president. First, a little background. He's 78 right now.
He's 79 in December, I believe. Yeah.
In November 20th, actually.
November 20th.
Dwight Eisenhower was the first president to turn 70 in office, and he turned that in the last few months or weeks of his second term. Okay, he's on the way out, and he was physically infirm for a lot of that second term. Then Ronald Reagan is elected at age 69, turns 70 in his first few months in office. And then in his second term is the subject of enormous speculation that he is senile or he is mentally declined too much to be president. And then, for some reason, we kind of enter this period where we elect older people. The 2016 election was Trump versus Clinton, was two 70-year-olds who were going to start at 70. And then Joe Biden, by the way, if Donald Trump had won a second term and it served all 4 years, that is an 8-year, two-term presidency, he would leave office at age 78, the same age Joe Biden started the presidency in, leading to he would serve until at least age 82, and if he were reelected to age 86. This is completely new territory in American politics, and I think Brit Hume has known Joe Biden a long time and covered him a long time and has seen the president slow down. And remember Jimmy Carter, who was now, 95, 96 years old, was asked if he could have served as president at age 80. Would he just have been up to it at age 80? And he said, absolutely not.
Let me add here.
A problem.
I wrote a piece for The Washington Post. I don't know that he's senile. I'm not a doctor, nor did I stay at a Holiday Inn. I have, however, guided two parents and two in-laws through their 70s to their going to their reward. And the ability to absorb facts and to change positions and to be flexible and the capacity, especially the capacity to not be offended by argument, vanishes. It accelerates. It exponentially diminishes as people get older. And this is when I say he lacks the capacity. I'm not talking about Chris Eliz is very upset with Jim Garrity and me for raising this issue. It isn't ugly politics. It's a national security dilemma right now. I just don't think he's responding in real time to what they're trying to tell him. And in fact, I've got Andrea Mitchell. Do I have that clip? Andrea Mitchell on Friday.
Ned, my colleague reported that
not
on
that
Saturday,
clip, but different one.
Not
that one. Dwayne will go and find it. It's where she says they tried to talk him out of it and they failed. She said that on Meet the Press. I don't think he's subject to argument.
They thought they could talk him out of it.
They thought they could talk him out of it, Byron. And I think that's the key to this.
Well, you know, on the one hand, Biden is a president who has observed the politics of Afghanistan or the war on terror for 20-plus years. And if he has felt that the United States needed to get out of Afghanistan for a long time and was determined to do it, that's determination. That's not senility, that's determination. The question is the way he has done this, and the whole reason we've been talking about this is it's been so disastrously handled. And so the idea of talking him out of it and saying, if it means no, U.S. doesn't get out of Afghanistan, then, I mean, I think, and I don't know your position, I think the U.S. should get out of Afghanistan. I just couldn't believe that Biden found this sort of way to do it.
My position is that we should have held 2,500 Americans and 5,000 NATO troops in air power indefinitely, gotten all the citizens out, and I believe as well that Secretary Pompeo, National Security Advisor O'Brien, both of whom have been on the show in previous days, agree that Donald Trump would have reacted to the Taliban breaching of the Doha Agreement, which began, obviously, in March when they attacked Forward Operating Base Chapman, where the CIA was headed, and seven Americans were wounded. That was a breach. I think he would have responded. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Trump definitely would have changed course, if only for the terrible press he'd been receiving if he did what Biden did. There's no doubt in my mind that he would have changed course. Now, Biden made the point early on when he was actually speaking publicly about this, made the point that the United States conducts counterterrorism operations in lots of countries in which it does not have a military presence. And he felt that the United States could do that in Afghanistan with a lot of special forces, CIA, various undercover people. I don't know if that's possible, but it was a reasonable position. The question was how to get from this point in which the United States still had troops in Afghanistan, and there were still NATO troops in Afghanistan, how to get from that point to the point where the U.S. conducts counterterrorism operations without a formal military presence. Biden found the worst way to do it.
Well, he hadn't done it. And he failed in trying to get there, and it continues to be a failure of epic proportions and of great danger. Keep your fingers crossed that no Americans are killed or left behind. Byron York, we'll talk to you next week on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Sense that most of the criticism is not of leaving Afghanistan, it's the way that he has ordered it to happen by pulling the troops before getting these Americans who are now stranded. Does he have a sense of that?
First of all, I think it's irresponsible to say Americans are stranded. They are not. We are committed to bringing Americans who want to come home home. We are in touch with them via phone, via text, via email, via any way that we can possibly reach Americans to get them home if they want to return home.
There are no Americans stranded is the White House's official position on what's happening in Afghanistan right now.
I'm just calling you out for saying that we are stranding Americans in Afghanistan when we have been very clear that we are not leaving Americans who want to return home. We are going to bring them home. And I think that's important for the American public to hear and understand.
That is Press Secretary Jen Psaki in the White House presser yesterday with Fox News channel Peter Ducey. I'm joined now by the New York Times, Michael Scheer. I don't know if he was in the room yesterday. He covers the White House. Good morning, Michael.
Yes, good morning. I was in the room. I was there for that moment. He clearly touched a sore spot there. She definitely you could hear the annoyance in her voice.
Okay, now, Michael, I've taken 20 calls this morning. First-time callers only, no screening for point of view. Are Americans stranded? Everyone says Americans are stranded. This is an objective issue. What is your assessment of her answer and why she gave it?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of what my assessment of the answer is, I think you're right. I mean, it's hard to square the idea that no Americans are stranded with what we all in the press and what, you know, people around the world are hearing from people who they know or who, you know, are reported on TV stuck in their homes, unable to get to the airport. So I think that's you know, it's hard to square those two factually. I think to your second question about why she answered that way, I think they're trying to convey to the American people the sense that, you know, sort of stranded kind of suggests that the United States has sort of given up and sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, all right, well, we'll just leave them there. And I don't think that's necessarily right either. I mean, you know, you do see the numbers of people who are being moved out all the time. You know, there's a lot of people that they're moving out. And we learned yesterday for the first time that the military is conducting kind of one-off missions to try to literally take helicopters from the airport you know, when they can do it safely and find Americans that are, you know, stuck outside the perimeter of the airport. So I think the reason she reacted that way was there was sort of an implication that the United States was just giving up on Americans, and I don't think that's true either.
No, it's not. In fact, I think after the crisis is over, however it turns out, we will hear extraordinary stories of heroism of American intelligence right. community and military operators going into very difficult circumstances and removing people, for example, who fell down and broke a leg, or people who are old and couldn't move, or contractors who are well-known by the Taliban and on a seek-and-destroy list. I think we're going to hear all those stories.
Yes.
But it seems to me, Michael, they're just not giving us the sense that they have a handle on this because they don't give us a minimum number of Americans who must come home to be a successful mission. And I don't understand that. I really don't understand. There are at least 7,000 Americans left, or there are at least 3,000 Americans left. Have you heard any minimum number?
No, they've been vague about it, and that's been frustrating for all of us. The one explanation that I heard yesterday that you know, maybe doesn't cover all of the cases, but might help explain a little bit, is that what they know is that there are some number of Americans who are dual citizens who probably have relatives, maybe not just their spouse or children, but, you know, they maybe have elderly parents in Afghanistan. They maybe have cousins, other people who they know can't get out. And so those Americans are going to choose not to come. And, you know, so I think what the administration doesn't want to do is to set a number and say, hey, you know, if we don't get 5,552 Americans out, we're, you know, it's going to be a failure because we will have left people there, because they don't have full control over how many Americans ultimately decide, yeah, I want to leave. And so that's my guess as to why they've been a little bit vague. But it's frustrating to all of us, especially those of us who are trying to write stories and say, you know, write the sentence that says this is how many Americans are still there.
Yeah, Ron Klain keeps tweeting the numerator. And I say that's good, but it's not good enough because I don't know the denominator. And if they gave us any kind of denominator, we could say, well, we've got 75% of the mission done. The United States has executed 50% of the mission or 90% of the mission. But they won't give us any kind of a denominator. And they could completely surround that denominator with all sorts of qualifications of the sort you just named. But the best answer would be, well, we know there are at least 3,000 people or 7 or 10 that have contacted us and want to get out. And we're working on that. We're working the problem.
Right. No, I think that's right. I mean, that's definitely the case for the Americans. On the Afghan side, the denominator, I've heard numbers from human rights groups and the like of about 100,000 Afghans that they sort of estimated, would need to be evacuated. But that number could be even bigger because what the American government has said is they want to evacuate not just the Afghans and their families who qualify for special immigrant visas, those are the ones that, you know, the folks helped us in the war effort, but also what they call vulnerable Afghans, which, you know, are women and girls and, you know, other people who are targeted by or could be targeted by the Taliban. And so I think that denominator could be very large.
It could be, in fact, and I also know that it's growing because the one case I've had a tiny role in, working with a congressional office of one interpreter. The interpreter brought his wife and extended family to the airport. The extended family, brothers, et cetera, were turned away. The interpreter finally got through via the intervention of more than one congressional offices. And this is a story that I don't think is being told, Michael Scheer. I know of at least four congressional offices that are deeply involved in trying to get people through the gate. Have you heard these stories? They're just swamped by friends of friends and Marines, et cetera. And I don't see any stories about. This is a remarkable effort by Congress to get people out because the executive branch is not functioning well.
I think congressional offices, I've heard of, obviously former military people, diplomats who have left, even, frankly, media. I was never in Afghanistan, but my colleagues who were had translators and people who obviously we, you know, helped us as well. And so there is an effort all around the country and frankly, I'm sure the world and other countries as well to try to get these people out so that they're not facing danger.
Now, the Washington Post just reported that William Burns, CIA director, had a face-to-face meeting with the head of the Taliban. And I'm sure they discussed specifics. Do you expect that the president is holding on to the 31st for as long as he can in order to maintain a commitment to the Taliban, and then they know that we're going to have to extend it if we haven't done it?
Yeah, look, our paper has confirmed the meeting as well. I think the administration's in a real bind. As you are aware, because you know about these military kinds of things, if they are going to get out by the 31st, you can't just, like, you know, pack up your bag. It doesn't take a half an hour to pack up your bags, right? Like, there's 6,000 troops and all their equipment that are sitting at that airport. And if all of those people are going to be gone by August 31st, you got to start packing up now or soon. And so they, you know, the administration is going to have to make a decision very quickly. Do you honor that deadline, not because you feel like you owe the Taliban something, but because you fear that if you stay longer, the Taliban and ISIS-K and the Haqqani network and the various, you know, sort of dangerous elements in that country will start attacking, they'll lose patience with the United States, and we'll sort of drop the facade of patience that has been at least in place for a week or so and put everybody in danger. And so they're going to have to make a decision sometime soon. Do we, you know, are we going to extend that for a couple of weeks? Or are we going to really get out by the 31st?
I have to think the greatest concern is that Haqqani especially, but other ISIS elements have grabbed Americans, and that they have an insurance policy. We don't know how big that insurance policy is, and it constrains what we can disclose. I understand all that, but I think they would be better served by candor on that. I also want one standard, Michael, and that standard is the Doha Agreement was surrounded by understandings, agreements, annexes, appendices. Whatever we do here will be surrounded by them as well. There will be secret agreements and codicils and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary Pompeo and National Security Advisor O'Brien from the Trump administration have both told me that the understandings they had with the Taliban were violated early this spring. And so I'm curious if you've heard the same thing, that President Trump would not have put up with this. And I just think the narrative is false and absurd that Trump would have put up with this or would have done anything remotely like this. Do you agree or disagree or don't know?
I don't know. I mean, I, as you know, I'm not really a military affairs reporter. I don't know kind of what those agreements and sort of side deals and side arrangements were. And it's hard to do a counterfactual, you know, what would have happened. So much about a Trump presidency, a second term Trump presidency, would have been, you know, different than what we're seeing here, obviously. But it's hard to know how that all would have played out.
True. I just think it's impossible to have played out this way because of his sensitivity, if only to the pictures. Last question. The Telegraph's Dominic Green writes today that Joe Biden's extended honeymoon with the U.S. media is over. Amid the fiasco of the Afghanistan withdrawal, the fact checkers have turned on him. There will be no turning back. Most of the American media were so unhinged by their loathing of Donald Trump and so excited by the prospect of reviving the Ray-Ban glory days of the Obama administration that they promoted Biden as the normal candidate and protected him from questions about his record and abilities. No longer. Your assessment of Mr. Green's assessment?
Well, I reject the premise that all of the media falls into that first category. I don't think, I mean, you know, I have spent the last 6 months writing very critical stuff about the president, about this president. So I reject that, though, you know, obviously that, you know, it's hard to generalize. And there are, I'm sure, some media that do fall into that category. I would say that this has been that we have not, as a media, let Biden off the hook on this. I wrote a 3,000-word story over the weekend, the headline of which was miscue after miscue. And so, you know, yeah, I think we've been tough, but I think we've been appropriately tough. This has been, I mean, you know, this is as you said, this is about human lives. This is a 20-year war that is ending and ending in, you know, badly and in chaos and with a lot of missteps. And, you know, that what we've always said throughout the Trump presidency is, you know, our job is to hold the president accountable and his administration accountable no matter who is in that job. We did it during Trump, and we're doing it, I believe, my job is to do it again with Biden. It doesn't matter who the president is, what party he's from. Our job is to ask tough, tough questions.
I agree. Thank you, Michael Shear, The New York Times. Follow him on Twitter at Shear, M, S-H-E-A-R-M. Good reporting all around. Follow me to relieffactor.com, great sponsor of the show. I told you I took it in the first hour. I take it every day, every single day, relieffactor.com, because I got to keep moving, got to keep getting out there, trundling, as I call it. It's a mixture of sort of walking fast and running slow is trundling. Anything between 10 and 15 minutes a mile is trundling. If you're over 15 minutes a while, you're shuffling. You might be in your own mind running, but you're shuffling, but whatever it is, you're moving. And that's what relieffactor.com is dedicated to, keeping you moving. Acarin, curcumin, resveratrol, and omega, the four natural supplements that many, many doctors believe are necessary for any healthy diet. It's the only supplement I take. It's the only supplement I endorse. It's the only supplement I have endorsed 20 years. I encourage you, please, I've taken in 20 years. I encourage you, please, take relieffactor.com. Give it a try at relieffactor.com. Stay tuned. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Andrew Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live on this Tuesday, August the 23rd, 24th, 2021, joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton, who serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Good morning, Senator. I know your time is short. Washington Post, New York Times reporting the CIA director met on Monday with the Taliban's leader. Were you and the Senate aware of that?
Hugh, no, but the Senate is not in session either, and we have very limited ability to have classified communications outside the senior leadership of the Senate. I will say that I hope that Director Burns' meeting with senior Taliban officials foreshadows Joe Biden's announcement that we will remain on the ground at the airport and out into Kabul for as long as necessary, and all the Americans who are, in fact, stranded in Afghanistan, despite what the president's spokeswoman said yesterday.
A member of your staff has been issuing updates about how your office has been flooded with and responding to requests for assistance from Americans and Afghan forces who helped us. It seems like it might be getting a little bit more under control. What's your sense of that, Senator?
Well, it's still pretty chaotic over there, Hugh. We still are constantly getting incoming from American citizens or their family members or folks who serve with Afghans who have been vetted and qualified for a special immigrant visa. We're doing everything we can at a minimum to get them the information they need and provide them some coaching and guidance about how to get to the gates, how to survive in the hot temperature, how to avoid the Taliban goon squads. In some cases, we have been able to, with friends and contacts inside the wire, actually pull them inside the wire and get them on planes. It's kind of disgraceful that a freelancing Senate office has to do this. This should be the responsibility of the State Department. But early last week, when we realized that so many Americans were stuck behind Taliban lines, we went into action, and I couldn't be prouder of the young men and women I've had working around the clock on this issue.
Now, Senator, I am assuming that eventually we are going to have to leave. Do you have any denominator? We know what the numerator is. They keep telling us, like Ron Klain, 21,000 Americans in the last 24 hours. Do you have any idea of the minimum denominator, that they will not give us a minimum number that they are certain of Americans who are there and a minimum number of Afghan allies? Do you have any idea what the minimum number is?
Hugh, not really, and not any more precise than what the administration has said publicly, you know, 10 to 15,000. I mean, part of me wonders if they don't want to reveal the actual numbers because it will be an indictment of President Biden's botched execution of his decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. I mean, you would think that the U.S. government would at least have a rough estimate within the numbers of hundreds. I mean, I understand some people might have left, you know, weeks ago to go to India or the Gulf or what have you. But you'd think that at least within a few hundred, our government would know. But if they do, they're certainly not sharing it with Congress or the American people.
Well, last question, Senator, I know you're rushed. There's tons and tons of military equipment there that will be in the hands of terrorists or the Haqqani network or Al-Qaeda or ISIS. After the Americans are out, what ought the United States to do about that equipment?
Well, Hugh, a lot of the equipment won't be usable in the long term. Like I doubt the Taliban have many Black Hawk pilots right now, and they certainly don't have access to parts and the fuel that they need. But unfortunately, the things that will be most usable to them are also the things about which we have the least control or the least ability to influence, and that's the man-portable weapons and equipment that were left behind in the tens of thousands, rifles, machine guns, things like night vision goggles. Even an illiterate Taliban fighter can turn the switch on a night vision goggle if it's got a couple AA batteries in it. That's a significant enhancement of their individual soldier lethality. And there's just not much that we can do about it anymore. Again, it's just an example of how slapdash and disorganized President Biden's execution of this decision withdrawal has been.
Very last question, Senator. Do you have any doubt we'll hear stories of heroism by the American military once this is over? I bet you they're going into harm's way daily to get people.
Oh, no doubt, Hugh. I mean, obviously, it looked extremely chaotic on the ground last week, but our military is designed to deploy into chaos and try to impose some kind of order. And you've all seen the pictures and videos of our soldiers and Marines caring for young children, sometimes lifting toddlers over concertina wire. I suspect there'll be some soldiers and Marines who prudently went beyond what they were instructed to do to prevent Taliban goon squads from beating people to death in front of them outside the gates of Kabul Airport. And I certainly hope that we'll soon see patrols into Kabul to collect up American citizens. If the French, British, and even Dutch can do it, then surely we can allow our troops and Marines to execute that mission to protect our countrymen.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you. I know it's your battalion, that it's your division that's there, the 101st, and I appreciate you joining me this morning on a busy morning. Talk to you next week. 1-800-520-1234, America. The downside of all this is that we have not been able to spend much attention on Haiti. And my emergency campaign to help Haiti and the food for the poor sponsorship of it is an amazing success. This is, in fact, just the beginning. They need help from the U.S. military, too, as John Kirby said yesterday.
We know there is much more work to do in Haiti to help the Haitian people, and we're committed to being there and to doing that for as long as possible. We're very proud of all the men and women of the department that are assisting in this effort and truly making a difference on the ground.
Even activist actor Sean Penn has been to a lot of disaster areas, comments on Haiti this way.
We have been at, from day one, with heavy equipment crews, still finding bodies. It's really awful, the circumstances there. It's very complicated. Medical teams are treating hundreds of people, both from very traumatic injuries to now increasingly gastrointestinal issues due to the rains and so on, you know, from infants to elderly.
It is a catastrophe as well. We are fixed on the Americans stranded in Afghanistan and our allies in Afghanistan, but unfolding very close to Miami is this catastrophe. Food for the Poor has been there from the beginning, but I read from this morning's Wall Street Journal, U.S. charity Food for the Poor said it was increasing security after its trucks carrying water, rice, beans, and Vienna sausages in Haiti were ransacked last week. It will now have police or private security accompany its vehicle, said Mark Corey, the organization's chief operating officer. I am actually surprised that that's the first time that's ever happened, given the desperation on the ground. But security is up, but we need more help. We need your $10, your $100, your $500, or more if you can afford to do it. Over at HughHewitt.com, you will see a banner that says Help Haiti. Please go there, be as generous as you can, or you can call 855-359-4973 and make your tax-deductible donation over the phone. That's 855-359-4973, 855-359-4973. It's misspelled here twice, but it's 855-359-4973 and at HughHewitt.com. Don't want to give you the wrong number. 855-359-4973. Thousands of people have called all the shows on the Salem Radio Network. I'm deeply appreciative of your support. If you gave once before and you can give again, they've got the security situation better for the trucks. The trucks are just full of sausage and beans and rice. Just the basics to keep people alive and keep them alive in desperate situations. If you're wondering what Senator Cotton was referring to, they are most definitely stranded. He's referring to Jen Psaki yesterday talking with Peter Ducey here at that exchange, cut number 10.
But does the president have a sense that most of the criticism is not of leaving Afghanistan, it's the way that he has ordered it to happen, by pulling the troops before getting these Americans who are now stranded? Does he have a sense of that?
First of all, I think it's irresponsible to say Americans are stranded. They are not. We are committed to bringing Americans who want to come home, home. We are in touch with them via phone, via text, via email, via any way that we can possibly reach Americans to get them home if they want to return home.
There are no Americans stranded is the White House's official position on what's happening in Afghanistan right now.
I'm just calling you out for saying that we are stranding Americans in Afghanistan when we have been very clear that we are not leaving Americans who want to return home. We are going to bring them home. And I think that's important for the American public to hear and understand.
Do you trust Jen Psaki? I don't. I don't trust this White House. They might have the intention, and I'm sure they do have the intention, of bringing home every American who wants to come home via an airlift out of Kabul airport. Do they have the capacity? I don't think so. I don't think the president has the capacity to respond to these events. What about Americans in Kandahar and Khost, in Mazar? There are Americans all over that country who are in hiding. How are they supposed to get to Kabul? Now, I do believe, mark this down, when this is all over, and we have the last helicopter leaving, we will begin to hear amazing stories of American special forces who are operating in close contact with the enemy, rescuing Americans. I'm sure that is going on. I am positive it is. I am sure that for every mission the British and French are doing, we are holding back and not telling us about our successes for fear of bringing to light those who are in danger. But I'll tell you this, some of that's probably, look, their media strategy, it's all been about optics from the beginning. I just don't have any confidence that optics aren't driving their every move. And they want to spring stuff at the end when people want to look back. They want to show us shiny new objects of successful rescues. And I will applaud the men and women who are behind those rescues, but I am very suspicious of this White House's ability to tell us the truth at any time.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.